Thank you, Indy, and thanks for all of you taking time out. I know there's a million other things you could be listening to right now, but instead you've come to listen to me tell you how to get a job. So thanks for coming, and I'm going to go ahead and get started. And I'm just going to say this now, but please interrupt me as we're going along. If you have questions, raise your hand, interrupt me, rather than trying to save them towards the end, because then you always forget, right? So interrupt me, and I'm happy to talk about anything you have questions about. I'm just going to start by talking a little bit about IIIS. Does anybody know what IIIS stands for? Call it out. I saw two hands, so don't fight over it. No, you got it exactly right. So IIIS is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. So that's who I work for. Despite the name, we are an international nonprofit dedicated to advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world. So that sounds like a big mouthful, but we do a little bit of everything related to science. It's kind of how I like to say it. We have people that do stuff related to science and human rights, science and the workforce issues, science and education, science and policy, science and international issues. So we've got people involved in all kinds of things. It is a membership-based organization. They like me to say that when I'm out on the road, so just so you know. And we are the publisher of a little magazine you might have heard of, right? Science is our publication's journal. But the thing I think you might be most interested in, and the reason I like to put up a slide talking about our organization at the beginning of any of my presentations, is our website, Science Careers. Has anybody heard of Science Careers before? A couple hands, a couple nodding heads. Well, if you haven't, it is what I believe is probably the most complete resource in terms of science career-related resources on the internet. And I promise, I used it all the time before I actually worked for the company. I send out articles to people because I thought they were really good articles, and I continue to do that. But so Science Careers, at sciencecareers.org, every Friday, 3 to 4 new articles related to career development go up there. So some of them will be very nuts and bolts advice, how to write your resume, how to network when you're looking for a job, the kinds of things that hopefully you're looking for if you've come to listen to this talk today. And there's also profiles of people in different career paths. So if you're looking to learn about what are some options with my science degree that I can go do, that's on there. Perhaps the most used part of the site is we actually have job ads on there. So when you're looking for job ads, it's one place you might think about going. And there's a couple of online communities on there as well. So we have a forum where you can go post questions and a dedicated group of volunteers who will answer career-related questions from how can I best network, what sort of jobs do you think I'm qualified for, what would my life be like if I was in this sort of position, and people will answer them. And there's also a couple communities on there. One is for clinical and translational scientists, which I don't think I'm at the right meeting to talk about that one, but another one for our Minority Scientists Network, an online community just getting started. So that's on there, you might be interested in that. And then, so I work for Science Careers as the part of the organization that I work in, and my job is to go around and give talks like this around the US. So if any of you are at an institution that you think, gosh, we really need more speakers on professional development topics, I talk on things like about the job search, about career options outside of research, work-life balance, working with your advisor. So if you are at an institution that's looking for that kind of thing, come talk to me afterwards, and I'd love to chat with you. I'm always looking for new places to go. So I won't make you listen to any more of my spiel about our company, and we'll move on to the topic of the day. So how many of you are applying for jobs right now? I see a couple hands. How about in the next year? Some more hands. How about in the future? Okay, so everybody should have raised their hand by now, unless you're going to be a tenure-track faculty member and you already have your job and you're going to stay there until you retire, right? We all eventually are going to look for a job. How about how many of you think you might apply for academic-type jobs? A handful of hands. How about industry-related kind of research? Some hands. Who's thinking, I'm going to do nothing related to research? Nobody? Okay, maybe you just don't want to admit it, but that's okay too. Hopefully you'll still get some useful things out of this today. I certainly think you will. How about who's an undergrad? Got a couple undergrads. How about who's in grad school? Good bulk of you. Postdocs? Any postdocs? No. How about beyond? Okay, a couple. Okay. So today we're going to talk about the various stages of a job search. And I think most of us like to think about our job search starting when we actually send out our applications, right? But I argue that you have to do a little bit of thinking about your job search before that. So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the sorts of things I think you should do as you're preparing for your job search. And then we'll talk about actually starting to apply for a job, sending out your CVs, resumes, and cover letters, and then actually interviewing for jobs. So those are the three things we're going to talk about. So as I said before, feel free to interrupt me if you have questions. So a few things. We're going to talk about basically every kind of job search, academic and industry, and every aspect of that from preparing to interviewing in the course of 2 hours. We're not going to get to quite everything. This is a lot to rush through. These are really idiosyncratic processes. So depending on the industry or the organization that you want to work in, it might work slightly different. If you're going to apply for a federal government job, for example, they have their own application process that's kind of unlike anything else. So this is a lot of good general advice, but you're going to want to do a little bit of research talking to people in your field and in the sorts of positions that you're interested in going into to make sure that what I'm saying matches up with the reality in your specific field, because it differs everywhere you go. And I'll try and point out some of the differences as we go, but I'll try. I think I got all that I wanted to say on that slide. I went backwards. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about preparing to search. We'll talk about your timeline, how you're going to figure out what your next step is, both in terms of your self-evaluation, in terms of thinking about what you like to do, and research on what some of your options are. And then we'll talk a little bit about doing some networking as you prepare to search. I know you've probably all heard that networking is the best way to get a job. I see some nodding heads. And I know it's one of those most frustrating things, particularly when you're a student and you're like, I don't have a network. So we'll talk a little bit about how you can do that today. So when do you think you should start your job search? Now? I saw you mouth that. You guys have to call out these answers because I'm going to keep asking you questions. Makes it more interesting for me. I don't just have to sit up here and talk. So right now, yes, okay, that's my obvious. It's never too early to start preparing for your job search. When in reality should you start? If you're a year out from when you want to start a job and you haven't given any thought to where you want to be, that's the time I really think you need to start the exploration phase. So again, this is going to be the time you start thinking about the careers that you want to go into, learning more about them, and learning more about how you should apply for those sorts of positions. About 6 months out is generally a good time to start sending out applications. That's going to differ a little bit depending, again, on the sector. Remember, we talked about this being an idiosyncratic process. If you're looking for academic jobs, we all know, or maybe we don't, but there is very much a cycle in academic jobs where the applications are due in the fall for the following fall. So then you're going to start sending out your applications earlier than 6 months, right, if you're going to go down that path. The federal government is notoriously slow, so if you're going to apply for federal government jobs, you should start applying earlier than 6 months. At the federal government, 6 months between an application and starting the job is actually short. And then hopefully by 3 months, you're starting to hear back about interviews and actually going to interviews. So I have some comics in here as well. Has anybody read these comics, phdcomics.com? If you haven't and you're looking for a good way to kill an afternoon, they're always amusing. But I put this one in there for a reason. As we're starting to talk about doing a little bit of exploration before we apply for jobs, he's got his life plan at the top, and it's very linear. He's going to finish college, go to grad school, pass his quals, and of course he lands his academic dream job and gets tenure and that prestigious career award, and it's all very nice, and it's all maybe the career we once thought we would have, but the reality is it doesn't have to go that way, okay? So hopefully your life reality is not quite the same as his, but you know, he goes to grad school, but he fails his quals, he works on random fruitless projects, and then he's still in grad school, and it's not quite what he thought was going to happen. So hopefully your life reality doesn't look like that, but I always think there's some value in stepping back and saying, is this really what I want to do, even if you have a plan in the back of your head. And here's a quote to back that up, and this is from a book about career decisions. And this author, Michael Shanazarian, says, consider that the average person sleeps 8 hours a day. That leaves 16 hours for other activities. From the time that we are roughly 5 years old through the time we retire in our 60s or beyond, most of us are involved in vocational activities, educational and work, one half or more of those remaining hours 5 days a week. If you're unfulfilled in your work life, your dissatisfaction will certainly affect other areas of your life. So I put that up there because sometimes I think particularly those of us who go to graduate school, start graduate school thinking, I'm going to be an academic. And then we decide we don't actually like being in the academic world. And regardless of where you are, I think there's some value in stepping back after you've finished your training period and saying, do I really like this path that I've started on? Is there another path I would be happier on? So that's kind of why I think the exploration process is pretty important. So one model that I like for career exploration is this decision cycle model. And it's a 7-step process. The first step, and I like the fact that it's a cycle, so we'll be talking about that in a minute, but the first step of the process is just awareness that you need to make a career decision about where you're going to go next. Which, if you're sitting here listening to me talk about job applications, you're probably aware that there's a career decision in your future, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't be thinking about job applications. So we've got step one done. Give ourselves a pat on the back. We've only got 6 more to go. So the next 3 I kind of group together. And the first one is basically doing a little bit of self-assessment. Thinking about what do you like to do? What are you good at? What are your skills and values? And you can do that in a variety of ways, formally or informally. We'll talk about a couple of them in a minute. Then doing a little bit of exploration and learning about what the options are and how you would get down those options. That's probably where you're going to go do some networking and some informational interviewing, which we'll also talk about in a minute. Then you kind of step back, and this is where I think it gets mushy. Step 4 is this integration phase where you think about what you're good at, what you like doing, and what the options are, and put them together. Hopefully from that you can decide on a path, and you're going to commit to that path, decide that you're going to do what you need to do to get down that path, and start implementing a plan. Which, that implementing a plan is going to be the sending out your job applications and interviewing for jobs is going to be part of that plan that we'll talk about later today. And then this is why I like this model, and I think there's value in it, is this last step. Step 7, reevaluation. You've probably all heard the statistics about the number of careers, the number of employers that people have these days before they retire. Long gone is the day where somebody takes a job right out of college, right out of grad school, and is in that job until the time they retire. That's kind of an old model, right? So the idea behind reevaluation is that you're constantly sitting back and saying, am I happy where I am, doing what I'm doing, or is there something that would be better? And guess where you go if there's something that would be better? You've reached step 1. You're aware that you need to make a career decision, and you're back on the cycle. So just some useful things to think about as you're thinking about deciding what your next step is. So the first 2 steps we talked about there are the self-assessment and research exploration stages. And there's a variety of ways you can do this, but I like to throw some of them out there kind of for brainstorming. I don't expect that anybody actually does all of this, because then you would be spending all of your time doing your career exploration and little time doing anything else. So there are a couple ways you can do the self-assessment. If you want to do it formally, you can go find these tests, and they're called things like the Strong Interest Inventory, the Jackson Vocational Interest Inventory, and you take basically multiple choice tests that will tell you, here's a good career option for you. Now, the problem with those is that they're not written for scientists, so they might tell you to be something completely unrelated. I know one career speaker, this guy, Peter Fisk, he's a geologist, and he does talks like this. And he talks about doing it, and they told him he should be a butler. Which, I'm not sure how useful that is. And Peter Fisk, when he is talking about it, he'll say, well, but there's some value in that. Sure, I'm not a butler, but I like to help people as I'm out on the road giving them career advice. And what does a butler do but try and help people and help them along? So, anyway, but sometimes you can take those tests and there'll be some value. Maybe it'll help you see that, gosh, it's telling me I really shouldn't have a desk job. I should think about that. It's telling me I really like to work with people. I should think about that. So there's some value in that. There are other ways you can kind of do some formal assessments. There, if you look at the book, What Color is Your Parachute? Has anybody heard of that book? Yeah. It's a classic job searching book, right? And there's a reason it's a classic. It's come out with a new edition every year since the 1970s because it's got some good advice in there. And we'll be talking a little bit more about it actually later. But the reason I bring it up now is he's got little worksheets you can work through as you're thinking about what your career path might look like. So again, it can be a little more formal way to think about it. You can also do a little bit of an informal self-assessment. And I have a slide in a couple of minutes that's got a whole bunch of things you might want to think about. But basically, you can do this informal thing in a variety of ways. You can journal about what you like doing about at work. You can journal about the things that are going really poorly at school and that you want to make sure you avoid in the future. I really hated this class. You can make pro and con lists about different job options, thinking about it. Make lists of your skills and values and preferences. Think about what you like and what you don't like. So there's a lot of ways you can do that. But the point is to just step back for a little bit of time and think about those things. So after that, you probably want to start researching your options. Maybe during that self-assessment, some particular options have come up. Maybe through talking to people, people have mentioned things. So there's a variety of ways you can do this. You can read books. There are books out there that are just books of different career options for scientists. You can pick them up, leaf through them, see what looks really interesting. Maybe you never thought about science writing, but you read a chapter in that book and you think, maybe that's where I should be. Or maybe you read it and it reaffirms that, yes, I really like what I'm doing. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing. You can read articles. I already mentioned the articles on science careers. There's a whole bunch of different things you can think about. You can also read things like business publications. Read your professional society's newsletters. See what they're saying about job options for people in your field. The Wall Street Journal has good career coverage about who's hiring right now. Maybe you want to take that into consideration as you're thinking about what job path you're going to go down. So you can do all of that. You can talk to another good resource would be to go talk to career counselors. There are people whose entire job it is to sit down with you and help you think about your career decisions. So make use of those people, either at your university. Sometimes you have access to them if you're a graduate student or beyond. Sometimes you'll have access to them at universities you already graduated from. There are also people who do it independently. And the people who do it independently, there are people who focus on working with scientists. There are people who focus on working with PhDs. So you can find somebody out there who will sit and talk and help you research and think about your options as well. And then finally, I would recommend doing some informational interviews to learn a little bit more about options. Has anybody heard this term before? Anybody want to define the term for me? No, nobody does. Okay. So an informational interview is just that. It's an interview for the sake of gaining information. So it has nothing to do with a job interview. So we'll be talking about those kinds of interviews later. But the idea is that just find somebody you want to sit down with and have a talk with about their career. And so you can ask them a whole bunch of questions. Basically, you're going to learn about your career options, learn about the organization they work for, and expand your network a little bit while you're talking to this person. So ask people who have the sorts of jobs you might be interested in going down for just a couple minutes of their time. And it doesn't need to be a lot of time. When I was on the job market, I started doing some of these with people in organizations I was interested in working in, and I found that often 15 minutes, a half hour was plenty of time. I went out to lunch with one woman, and then I realized like I really did not have enough to say to last the course of an hour about career issues with this woman. So an hour was too long. 15 minutes, 30 minutes was plenty. One question I get a lot when I'm talking about informational interviews, how do I ever get people to agree to do that? Why would they ever want to do that? Well, the reality is people, if you ask them for a couple minutes of their time, they will agree because of two things. First of all, they like helping people, right? And it makes people feel like they're helping somebody if they're sitting down with you and talking about your career options. So that's number one. But number two, people like talking about themselves. You're asking this person to just sit down with you and tell you all about them because they're fabulous and you want their job. It makes people feel good about themselves that somebody thinks they have that valuable information and they're willing to sit down and have that conversation with you. So as long as you can find the contact information of somebody who's got that interesting career, that's all you need. Asking them, I've never had somebody not agree to do it. They might ignore your first email because they're really busy, but you could always email again. Email two or three times. If they don't respond after the third email, leave them alone. They're not going to respond. Or try and call them, because it's a lot harder to say no once you've got somebody on the phone. So you'll ask them about a few things. You'll ask them a little bit about their present. Tell me about your current position. Tell me about your current organization. What do you do on a daily basis? Ask them about their past. How did you get into your field? How did you get this job where you are right now? Ask them about the future. What's the direction of this field? Where will the job openings be when I'm on the market? And just ask them for advice, contacts, feedback, those sorts of things. And we'll be talking again a little bit more about that in a second, sorts of questions you might want to ask them. So here's Mike, another one of our comics. Mike's at the Career Center. So what kind of job are you looking for? Preferably the kind that pays. My wife was very specific about that. Well, let's take a look at your Myers-Briggs test results. Based on your distinct personality profile, the Myers-Briggs test can recommend the job type that best suits your particular inclinations and abilities. So my ideal job is grad student or farming. So like we said before, those tests aren't always going to give us the most valuable information, but hopefully you can distill what they say down to one piece of advice. So we talked earlier about sitting back and thinking about doing a little self-exploration about our skills and values. So what sorts of things might you want to ask yourself about as you start to think about what job you want to go down? Nobody has any ideas about the sorts of things you might want to think about when you're choosing a career.
Location.
Location. That can, location in a couple different ways. It could be, I want to live in this specific city. What industries are big in that city? If the industry you really want to work in isn't big in that city, how are you going to compromise? It might also be, I want a job that's going to let me work from home, where I don't have to go to the office every single day, so I get some telecommuting flexibility. What other sorts of things might you want to think about?
Flexibility, if you have a family.
Flexibility. So that might be in terms of, again, flexible hours. It might be things like, does the job require a lot of travel, and how much is that going to impinge on your schedule? It could also be flexibility in terms of the work hours. People work differently, right? There's some people who, at the end of school, are so ready for a 9-to-5 job. Okay, I was this person. I was like, I'm done working late at night. I'm done working on the weekends. I do some of that now when I travel, but I wanted to be able to say at the end of the day, I'm done working. I'm going to go home and stop working, right? I see some nodding heads. Some people are thinking, yes. There are other people, and I've talked to people like this before, who say, sometimes I'm just inspired at midnight. And if I'm inspired at midnight and I can't sleep because I'm thinking about work, I'm going to get up and work. And then maybe I'll go to bed at 4 a.m. Well, if you're that kind of person and that's the schedule you work on, maybe you want to think about what job options would cater to that sort of a work ethic. What other sorts of things might you want to think about?
Demand.
Yeah. So it's not just about what you like, but are people actually hiring people to do this right now? If nobody's going to hire you to do that because there's no there's not enough money in that particular field, or because there's a whole bunch of people trying to go into that field, maybe it's not the best place to go. Anything else?
I guess blame yourself. If you blame yourself, what kind of job you want, and blame yourself towards that goal. So as coursework, as you know, research or whatever you do, but blame yourself for that goal.
Sure. Do you have the skills necessary for that job? If you don't, is there a way to get them before you're applying for jobs? Might be part of that. Okay, anybody have anything else before I show you my list? No. Okay. So one thing nobody said is, what do you like to do? What energizes you? I know when I was applying for jobs, one of the things I was thinking about is that I really like working with people. I hate sitting in an office all day long by myself. That is the most horrible thing to me. I'm energized by working with people, so that was important to me. Do you want to do lab work, research, field work? We talked about, where do you want to work? How about, what do you want to wear to work? I had somebody say to me, God, you know, the thought of a job where I have to wear a suit every day just horrifies me. I would never take that kind of job. That's fine. Do you want a job where you can wear jeans? Do you not care? You can not care about that question, too. How often do you want to change projects? Do you want a job where you take a project that lasts a really long time and you're mainly focused on that one project? Or do you want the kind of job where you're switching up projects constantly and you're always working on new things, and in the course of a day you might work on several different projects? We talked about the hours you might want to work. We talked a little bit about travel. How about funding situation is another one you might want to take into account. How do you feel about being in a job that's grant funded, or does that make you stressed out? Or you might also think about being in a freelance position or in a startup. How does that feel as a funding situation, or do you want something a little bit more secure? Oops. You might have non-science interests or skills you want to use. Think about how you might combine that with your training and come up with a good job. One clear one is somebody who really likes to write might think about ways to combine their writing with their science. You might think about things like income level, job security, and stress levels. Do you want to work independently or as part of a team? So all kinds of things you might want to think about as you're starting to think about the career. How about things you want to ask other people? In the context of doing informational interviews, what kinds of questions would you want to ask people?
Probably any of the things on the previous list. You know, what's the stress level? What kind of things do you have to wear?
Sure. All of those things are probably good things to ask. I've never had somebody turn that back, but that was like the perfect answer. Yes, you should ask all those things. Anybody have anything else they would ask? So I would ask them, what attracted you to this field? Why did you get in this field to begin with? what do you like most or least about your position? Maybe they'll say they really like something that sounds horrible to you, or maybe what that really bothers them wouldn't bother you. That's good to know. I'm always curious, what do people do on a typical day or week? What do you spend all of your hours doing? I think we know a lot of times in an academic environment what a job looks like, but because we don't always have exposure to other environments, we don't necessarily know, and I think it's a really interesting question to ask. How did you break into the field? What do I need to be doing to ensure my own success? Ask them about the skills they use and how we can better develop those skills so you can land that job. Ask about professional associations. You know, a lot of times, professional associations are the places to go for information about what else, the profession, right? So ask them what they belong to. There might be one you're not familiar with that might have some valuable information for you as you plan your own career. And job listings as you're starting to apply for jobs. And then I always like to just end by asking, what advice would you give to somebody interested in your line of work? And then finally, and this is, I know it's not on my slide, but the other thing I like to ask is, who else should I talk to? If this person was a valuable networking contact and had valuable information you can use in your career, chances are they know other people who have valuable information. So I would ask that as well. So the other thing, you want to be doing some other networking while you're thinking about your job. And again, this is going to be helpful at different stages of the job search. First of all, we talked about networking already in the context of informational interviews in order to learn more about what some options are. But it's also going to be helpful as you start applying to positions to find out about where some openings are, and also to be able to do things like pass your application materials directly to the hiring manager of a position you're applying to follow up on job applications that you've submitted. So it's not just helpful now, but it's going to be helpful throughout the process. There are a lot of things you might think about to network. We already talked about informational interviews. The other thing I would say is it's important to remember that everybody you know is a part of your network. So your family and your friends, people you know from outside of work, your neighbors, people you went to school with years ago, your boss's network, all of those people are people you want to be thinking to in terms of reaching out to and saying, hey, I'm starting to look for jobs. Do you know of anything interesting in this field? Do you know anybody in this field I should talk to? And see what they come back with. You never know where that person is going to be who's going to help you along the way. A friend of mine who runs the postdoc office at NIH talks about when she was looking for her own postdoc, or when she just finished her postdoc and was looking for a job, and she wanted to move back to Michigan because she'd grown up in Michigan. But she didn't really know that many people there anymore. But she started reaching out to her family and saying, hey, I'm really interested in this particular, she's a biologist, this particular pharmaceutical company. Who do you know in that company? Well, nobody in her family knew anybody in that company, but sure enough, her sister-in-law worked at a law firm, and one of the lawyers at the law firm knew somebody at the company. And there you go, Lori had her contact. And she was able to do an informational interview, pass off her job application, and she didn't end up moving to Michigan. So that kind of, it'd be a perfect story, wouldn't it, if she got the perfect job from it. I don't have that story. But she did get that contact, and she got the information she was looking for. And she would have never thought to go to her sister-in-law, who was a paralegal, and say, hey, can you help me get a job in the pharmaceutical industry, right? So you never know who that person is going to be. So I think it's, when you're job searching, it's always a value to talk about your job search to everybody you know. The other thing is to think about, there's some events that are made for networking, right? You see those networking receptions at conferences, and a lot of times you think, oh God, I really don't want to go to that, because then I have to talk to people I don't know, right? They're really uncomfortable. Does anybody like going to them? No, I don't see any hands. And I admit myself, I talk to people about how you can best succeed at those kinds of events, but they're not my favorite either. But you choose to go to them, and then when you go to them, you have to do something. You have to not sit and talk to your friend who you go to school with and you talk to every day, right? You have to actually go talk to new people. So we can, if you want to talk more about that later, we can talk about how to make those receptions easier to go to. That's another place to go for networking. Maybe alumni events. I know I get emails from my undergraduate institution all the time that are like, we're having this great event. Do you want to come? And who's there but people to network with? Social networking sites. So this would be things like LinkedIn. Is anybody on LinkedIn? I see a couple hands way in the back. So LinkedIn is like the professional world's Facebook. And the thing that I think it's particularly valuable for is finding those contacts within companies. So you get on LinkedIn, And you start making your network, connecting with people you went to school with, people who've graduated and now work in companies, your contacts who are not necessarily in your direct field, and then you know what you can do? You can search. So say you really want to work at a specific company, you search for the name of that company, and if somebody in your network is connected to somebody in that company, they'll be able to introduce you. And then all of a sudden you've got that contact you want, you can talk to them, you can do an informational interview with them over email or the phone if they're not local, and you've expanded your network. So I think there's some value in those websites, even though to some extent sometimes they seem like online Rolodexes, right? They seem to be more a collection of the people you know than anything else. You can mine them and find people. You can search by city. If you're thinking, gosh, I really want to live in a specific city, my partner got a job in that city and I really need to find a job in that city, you can search by all kinds of things. So I've used it. Sometimes I do things like plan panel discussions at events in cities I've never been to. So I was doing this last May. I had to find panelists for a panel discussion on careers in industry in Cambridge in the UK. I don't know anybody there. I don't know a lot of industry scientists. But I managed to search on LinkedIn, get some of my contacts to introduce me to their contacts, and I filled my panel. The other thing that I think is particularly a useful networking strategy, but we don't always think about it as that, is volunteering. So find opportunities on your campus or on your professional or in your professional associations to do some volunteering, either at events or on committees. You'll get to work with people a little bit more closely, so they'll actually get to know what kind of a person you are to work with, not just he or she happens to have an interest in this field. So those can be, and particularly because those will be people working specifically in the areas you want to be in, they could be particularly valuable networking contacts. The other thing that's important is not that you just go meet these people once, because I'd argue that if you meet somebody once at a networking reception, they're not actually part of your network until you've had some kind of follow-up contact with them. So you should always get somebody's business card when you meet with them, take it home, and email them later. And it could be, you know, thanks for talking to me, I really enjoyed meeting you. You could email them and be like, I read this article and I was thinking of our conversation, it was a really great article. You can email them more directly and be like, I'm starting to do look for jobs and I'm looking to talk to people who work in this industry because I want to learn more about that industry, right? You're never going to directly ask anybody for a job because that puts people on the spot, makes them uncomfortable, but you can ask them if they know of job openings. You can ask them to put you in contact with specific people, that sort of thing. As you're doing this networking too, I think it's a good idea to have business cards. Does anybody in the audience have business cards? Oh, good. I see a bunch of hands. And I know you probably think, God, I'm just a grad student. I don't need business cards. I don't want to spend money on business cards. They don't pay me very much. But they don't have to be expensive. One of the things I recommend doing if you're a graduate student, first of all, you can look and see if you can get them printed by your university. It's often only $20 or $30. And you'll get a huge box, more than you'll ever use. The other thing you can do, and this is what I recommend if you really don't want to spend much money, you go get the paper at Office Depot or Staples or whatever, and it's perforated business card size paper. You run it through your printer and you print business cards. Well, what do you put on the business card? Look at your university's website. The printing office will likely have a picture of what a typical business card looks like. It'll typically have a logo on it, which maybe you copy and paste. I don't know how that fits into copyright law, but take that with a grain of salt. Look at that, look at the contact information on there, put your contact information, print them off. You don't have to print many at a time. You can split this pack of paper that's going to be $10 with three of your friends because you're each only going to use a few sheets of paper, and you've got business cards. You didn't spend a lot of money. And the value in the business card is as you're out there talking to people, you can just hand them to people, and then when they go home, at some point they're going to empty their pockets. And what's going to come out of their pocket is your business card with your contact information, and they have to think about you a second time. So maybe they'll pull that card out and they'll go, oh yeah, we had a really great conversation about X, Y, or Z. I'm going to email them because I was thinking about this resource they could use. Maybe they pull it out and throw it away. I don't know. But the thing is, somebody's got your contact information. They can pull out and look at it later. The other thing is, it's part of the professional world. There's nothing more awkward than being at a conference like this and having somebody say, hey, can I have your business card? And you have to say, oh, no. I highly recommend making some, even if you just make a few. I had a couple different versions when I was in graduate school, depending on who was paying for me to go to a specific conference, I would put their information on it. You can do a bunch of things. I recommend having them, though, as you're networking. They can be valuable. So we talked about LinkedIn. If you haven't seen a LinkedIn profile before, I just thought I'd throw mine up there. So you can see it's got information about my current position, my past position, my education, And then I just have my bio up there. It's the same bio I use other places. So anyway, it is not all that different than you would expect a profile to look like on this kind of a website. So here's another one of our contacts. Mike's talking to his wife, and he tells her, "Don't worry. Finding a job's all about networking. Who you know, who they know, who knows them, who knows that they know that you know them. Right now, I have my entire network of contacts working overtime to get me employed. A couple of the other grad students talking to the janitor. Well, my cousin has a hardware store in Mexico. Does he need a PhD? They do need a manure salesman." So Mike certainly got them talking to everybody they know. Hopefully your networking is a little bit more useful than that. Although, I don't know, maybe you work with manure in agronomy sciences, right? Anybody work with manure? No. Okay, well, it was the only place I've ever been where that might be something you would do. I just spent a lot of time talking about preparing for the job search, and we're finally going to get down to what you probably actually want to hear about, which is more about actually applying for positions. So we're going to break this down into three sections. First, you have to find positions to apply to, right? So we'll start talking about that. We'll talk a little bit about CVs and resumes, putting those together. And then we'll talk a little bit about other materials you might be submitting as a part of a job application. Oops. So where would you think about going to look for job openings? Yeah. Excellent, yes, society websites. I think that's pretty clear. Societies think about jobs. I already mentioned having them on our website. I'm sure ASA, CSA, I'm sure they all have job ads on their websites. Where else might you go?
For everyone here, there's a career placement center downstairs in the exhibit hall.
Professional meetings. They often have some sort of job assistance. Where else?
Companies' websites,
yeah. If you think there's a really cool company you want to work at, go to their website, see what they're hiring people for. As a matter of fact, even though you're supposed to get your job through networking, and that's the most common way people get their jobs, I got my job from looking at the AAAS website because I knew they were a cool organization, and sure enough, they had a job ad that was perfect, and I applied and got it. So, company websites. You guys, come on. Somebody told me you were looking for a job now. Those of you who are looking for a job now, where are you applying?
Google it.
Huh?
Google.
Use keywords for jobs you're looking for. See what you find. They're maybe not Google, but maybe you want to go to some of the Career Builder, those sorts of websites. Those websites exist. There's jobs advertised on them.
Career fairs.
I'm going to throw out a big, I don't know about career fairs. What I think career fairs are good for is there are companies there who have tables and are sitting there ready to tell you all about how great it is to work at their company. So sure, go talk to them. Ask about what it's like to work at their company. But don't count on necessarily getting a job. What you can get from a career fair, the most important thing you can get from a career fair, is a business card from the hiring manager or a business card from the recruiter, who you can then follow up with and have a more informed conversation and remind them of who you are. But you're not going to walk. I think some of us hope and think we'll walk into a career fair, hand out our resume, and walk out that day with a job. And that rarely happens, unfortunately. Anybody have any other ideas? Yeah, Chronicle of Higher Education, Inside Higher Ed, Higher Ed Jobs. If you're looking for a job in the academic environment, those are the places to go, are going to be those sorts of newsletters. Okay, I'll show you my list. So networking is number one. There's all kinds of research out there that something like two-thirds of all people get their job through networking. Okay, so that's why we already talked about networking and how important it is to do. In the professional, in the academic context, you often hear about, for example, advisors calling somebody who's at the university that you're applying to, who they happen to know, to tell them that your grad student is applying and what a great person they would be for the position. So that's, even in the academic world, it happens. In the rest of the world, that's often how you find out about positions that are open. You talk to people, they tell you, you talk to somebody in the company and say, hey, put in a good word for me. So that's one way. We talked about professional organizations and conferences. We talked about institution and company websites, job boards, and career fairs. You guys hit my list pretty good. Okay. So there's a whole bunch of ways you can apply for jobs. What should you actually be doing? Well, and if you look at, what Richard Nelson Bowles writes in, I told you we would talk about what colors your parachute later, he says that there are a few different ways you can look for jobs. The easiest are going to be, of course, applying for jobs online and through ads and journals, those sorts of things, blindly applying, coldly applying. Unfortunately, those are not going to be the best ways to get actual jobs, okay? I already told you I got my job that way, but that's unusual. Something like 4 to 24% of people who go down those paths get their jobs that way. Again, that may differ by sector or industry, but those are not the best ways to go be looking for jobs. The better ways are going to be asking for leads from your network, seeking out contacts within specific organizations. Companies like to hire from within because it's less risky for them. If they're hiring somebody they know or somebody that one of their workers knows, they know you're coming to the table as somebody who's going to be able to pull off what they want you to be able to do in that job. They don't necessarily know that when they're hiring somebody who they have absolutely no experience with. So they actually, companies prefer to hire people from one of those sorts of methods, which is frustrating because they're not the easiest ways to go down a job search. The only other thing I would say about this is if right now in this sort of economy, if you think about applying for jobs online, there are a whole bunch of people who are unemployed. And they're sitting at home, and what are they doing with their days? They're firing off applications to job ads that are posted online. And if you talk to people who are hiring right now and who have listed their jobs online, I've been hearing all kinds of shocking estimates about the number of applications they're getting. Way more applications than they can even consider or think about because it's so easy to apply online. And it takes more work to do all the other things. Okay, so now that I told you that and that's frustrating and you're like, ugh, I wish you would stop talking and telling me things I don't want to hear. That's okay, because you can still do that in case you get a job that way. You combine a bunch of methods, so do a bunch of these things. Talk to people out there, find out about job openings they know about, still do your networking, and apply online. Combine it all and see what happens. That's what you do. That's going to help you get a job faster and hopefully not get as burnt out. The other thing that becomes a danger with the jobs, the ads, applying for jobs online and why you end up getting so many applications and why that's frustrating for hiring managers is that a lot of times people are just firing off the same resume, the same application to all of these different companies, to all of these different kinds of positions. And they're not taking the time to sit back and tailor their resume, tailor their documents, learn more about the company or the position so that they can really show that they have what that company or position is actually going to require. So if you're doing things like talking to your contacts about specific job openings, you're able to learn more about the positions that are open out there and how to sell yourself to the company in a way that shows that you have those skills. Does that make sense? Okay. So a couple quotes in here about job openings, and this is from Brooke Allen, who sometimes writes for the Science Careers website. And he says, and this is related to what we were talking about, every so often, you might find an employer who's good at finding hidden talent, but don't count on it. So take full responsibility for getting found. And he makes all kinds of arguments about, he uses this term, and I hate it, but I think it demonstrates what he's getting at. He talks about being a promiscuous networker. And so he's one of these people who's forever tossing his business card out at people, and he apparently keeps a list, an email list of every single person he's ever met that he will email at least once a year to tell them what he's up to. And if he's looking for, he has all these stories, if you ever hear him talk about how when he's trying to network, he'll email that list for, one of the examples was his son was studying in Sweden and needed a part-time job. And so, sure enough, Brooke Allen emailed his list and came up with 5 or 6 part-time jobs for his son. So he's one of those people who demonstrates the value of networking. He's also, he'll tell you some really crazy strategies for job searching, but that get at this networking idea, where he's done things like when he's looking for jobs and a company has a hiring freeze, taking somebody out to lunch and ask them about all of the problems their company is currently dealing with. And he says, okay, well, let's go home, went home, this particular instance, solved all of those problems, and then said, let me take you out to lunch again. Well, everybody likes a free lunch, right? So the guy went out to lunch with him again, and Brooke said, well, now I've solved these problems that you had. Okay, well, sure enough, what does he get out of that? A job offer. So again, using networking and demonstrating how you're using your skills to the employer, they know they're getting somebody who can do the work because now he's proven himself. He's a proven commodity. So I'm not necessarily recommending that you do that. It's just kind of an extreme example of how networking can be useful. So we're starting to think about our CVs and resumes. Another one of our comics, how to turn your CV into a resume. Your contact information's at the top, your academic positions. Then you cross out all those publications, teaching experience, and move your real world work experience up to the top. So, and trim it down to one page. Good luck. So what's the purpose of a CV or resume? Because companies like to torture you in asking you to write them?
No, it's to show the company that you're applying for that you have the skills that would help them achieve their goals.
So maybe it's to show them the skills you have. I would argue it's a little bit simpler than that. You're just trying to get an interview. You're trying to sell them on you just enough that they will bring you in for an interview. And in the interview, you're going to tell them all kinds of things more. Because you really can't put everything in the short little document. How about, what's the difference between a CV and a resume? A CV is longer, yes. Any other differences? Yeah, your CV is going to be a little bit more targeted towards research. Your resume is going to be a marketing document. Your CV, you're going to think a little bit more of as a comprehensive list. And we'll talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. How about which one do you use for which positions? Nobody?
We use the CV for positions within academia and the resume within industry.
Yeah, and sometimes you'll see in industry research positions, sometimes you'll see a modified type shortened CV, but still focusing on your research. So the basic rule of thumb, if you're applying to academia or something research focused, use a CV. If you're applying to something not research-focused, you use a resume. That might differ again. We talked about this being an idiosyncratic process where things differ. It might differ depending on where you're applying. So if you have a contact within the company, that's perfect because you can say, hey, which would the company rather see, my CV or a resume? If you're applying to somewhere where there's a little gray area about what you might want to apply with. So here's my little chart, and this is on the handout that you picked up at the beginning, going through the differences between a CV and a resume. So as we talked about, a CV is going to be that longer, more comprehensive document. I kind of think of it sometimes as like a laundry list. Like, it's got everything on it, right? Your resume is going to be a little bit more tailored. It's going to be a summary of who you are because you're just trying to get that interview where you can tell them more. So a CV is going to be a full listing of your background and your research, whereas the resume is a brief snapshot of skills and experiences. Again, we talked about the length. So a CV, the length is flexible. Might be a little bit shorter for industry positions. Your resume, 1 to 2 pages. You'll hear one is a pretty common length given. I think if you've got a PhD, you can go up to 2 pages. The thing to remember is that there's still a concept of resume real estate. So if you hand that 2-page resume to a company, they're still only going to spend their 10 seconds or whatever it is they spent on a resume, right? They don't spend a lot of time looking at these documents. But with that 2-page document, probably the majority of that time is going to be spent on that first page. So even if you have a 2-page resume, don't count on them reading whatever you put on the second page. Make sure you know, it's resume real estate, real estate, real estate, real estate. That's the most important thing. Put the most important stuff up front. So in a CV, you're going to be focusing on publications, presentations, research, those sorts of things more related to your research. And the resume is going to be a little bit more focused on skills and experiences, again. And we already talked about where they're used. So, and this is where I really invite you to interrupt me and ask questions, because because we're trying to talk about every aspect of a job search in a short amount of time, I'm going to blow through this kind of quickly. So ask me questions now, okay? So these are the categories you might think about putting on your resume. You might not have all of these, particularly if you're trying to get a 1-page document done. I'd be shocked if you got all of these in a 1 or even 2-page resume. So it's going to be tailored depending on the position you're applying to and what they want to see. You're not just going to have 1 resume. You have 1 resume for every job you apply to, and you change it everywhere you send it. That's important to remember. That's going to make your job search easier and quicker. So first you're going to have your contact information at the top, right? You don't need to put resume at the top. That's a waste of space. You're going to start with your contact information. Make sure it's reliable contact information, a phone number you can actually be reached at. One other piece of advice I've heard here is to make sure that you're actually putting your home contact information, particularly if you're applying to some private companies. They do not like to contact you at what they think might be your work. So even if you're a graduate student, I would recommend putting your home address on there. It's never going to hurt. Things you don't need on there that are sometimes common in other countries, this is a cultural difference, don't put your age, don't put your social security number, marital status, number of children you have, any of that, leave it off. Companies are particularly anxious about some of that information because they're worried about looking like they're discriminating against people based on age because they knew your age when you were applying for the job. So leave that all off. How about an objective statement? You think you should have an objective statement on your resume? No, I see a no. Good. That was a trick question. If anybody said yes, then I would hate telling you no. So you see these sometimes, and they're like, to obtain a job in the pharmaceutical industry where I use my skills and experiences. Does that add anything of value to a resume? No. It says, I want the job I'm applying for. Right? There's no reason that you want to put that on your resume. You're wasting space, okay? So yank the objective off there if you have one. If you think you've got a really great objective on your resume, come talk to me later and we can talk about whether it's really great and you should leave it on there. But overwhelmingly, pull it off. One thing you might put at the top, and I think this is a much more valuable use of that prime resume real estate, is going to be a summary of your qualifications. So this might be focusing on the particular skills you have, a summary up front to make sure that they understand exactly what you're bringing to the job. If you do this, tightly tailor it to the job that you're applying for. Look at the job ad online and mirror those keywords in this section. One of the things we talked about, how quickly they're going to be looking at your resume, they're not going to be spending a lot of time on it. In that short amount of time, they want to be able to see that you have all the things that they were looking for in the job ad. Yeah?
I've heard in other places where they say if you repeat the keywords from the job application, they don't want to see that, but you think that's a good thing?
I think it's a good thing, because if they're only spending 10 seconds looking, the question was whether you should repeat the keywords from the job ad on your resume. I think it's a good thing, and the way I've heard it said is if they're only spending 10 seconds looking at your resume, they have to, in that 10 seconds, think of, here's what I was looking for, here's what this person brings to the table. If they can see so clearly, they clearly bring this to the table because they have this keyword there. I think it makes it a pretty easy connection. It sounds a little bit like dishonest and a little bit like cheating, like I just have to take what's in the job ad and put it on my resume. Well, no, it still has to be honest, right? It should still be tailored to your experiences. But, you know, particularly for places that are doing things like keyword searches of databases of resumes, that's also going to get you noticed. So I would make sure to put those in there. And that summary of qualifications, one place where you really want to think about putting that in is if you're applying to jobs unlike jobs that you've held previously. Because that allows you to have a section where you can really sell yourself and say, demonstrate how you fit what they're looking for. So they don't then have to take your other positions, which may be unrelated to what you're applying for, and kind of do a lot of mental math and figure out how you do fit. Yeah.
Question on that. For our institution, one of the things that's often included on the job description is that you work or have the ability to work with women and minorities. How would you build something like that into your summary of qualifications that it's kind of hard to prove if you haven't done some specific active role?
You wouldn't necessarily want to make sure you have everything in the job ad in that list. But if I was trying to say something like that, you can make a statement like experience working with women, minorities, and people with disabilities, or something like that. Just make it a bullet point, and then hopefully in an interview they would say, "Hey, you have this listed on your resume. Can you tell me more about that?" And then it's not necessarily something formal. You could say, "Well, I was a member of this club in college, and it was mostly made up of X, Y, or Z. I worked in this work environment." You know, it's not necessarily something formal, but you could put that up there, particularly if you thought it was something that they really wanted in that job ad. Or it could be something more formal. Maybe you were a Girl Scout in the past or something, so that's your experience working with women. But that's where I would put that. And you know, the other thing to keep in mind, and I think this is on a later slide, but I'm going to say it now because it's on my mind, as we're talking about matching job ads to your resume, you don't necessarily have to have every single thing they're looking for in a job ad to apply. One good rule of thumb is if you have about 60% of the qualifications they're looking for, go ahead and apply. Now, it might be this is a little caveat about the economy, right? That in this economic situation, people are able to get more than 60% in people who are applying for a job. But a common rule of thumb, if you get 60% of what they're looking for, apply for it, because it's really pretty rare to find somebody. You know, people write job ads as these grandiose dream things of what would a perfect employee be, and they're not necessarily very realistic.
Do you have any hints for spotting the jobs where they already have somebody? The person's been doing the job for 4 years, and now they're legally going to, or they're going to officially hire them.
So that,
you don't waste your time.
That is one thing that sometimes, particularly in the federal government, they're required to post positions, but they already have somebody in mind who they're going to hire. Occasionally, they get in perhaps an application that's better than the person that's there. But one thing to really look for is a short advertising period. So if they put the job ad up and it's only going to be up for 2 weeks, you know, chances are they've already got somebody picked out. That's the primary sign that you can find. Or if it's written and it's so narrowly focused that there's no way anybody would bring that kind of skill to the table unless they were a specific person, that can sometimes be another sign, but that's a lot harder to read through the lines. And that can be a really frustrating thing, because particularly even in the federal government, even if they've got a person picked out, they're still required to interview 3 people. So my mother works in a very small niche field. She works in rare book conservation, okay? There's not a lot of people in rare book conservation. There's not a lot of job openings. Often they'll have somebody picked out already. So she, when she's applying for federal government jobs, because that's where people in that field tend to work, she'll get an interview, and as soon as she walks in the door, she realizes, oh, they already have the person picked out. So anyway, that can be particularly annoying. Yeah.
I'd like to offer, though, on the other hand, I see what you're saying. If it's just been advertised 2 weeks, that's a surefire sign. But I know the job that I currently have, my network indicated to me that someone had already kind of had the inside track for the job. And I would like to encourage everyone, don't let that discourage you, because I'm living proof you can still, you know, run your own race. And especially in academia, these are committee things, and you can still beat out that person that has the inside track.
Oh, absolutely.
So don't let it discourage you.
Absolutely. Even if you think they've already got somebody picked out, there's no harm in applying. It's going to take you a little bit of time, but you still could get the job. And particularly, yeah, in the case of academia, where it's going to be a committee making the decision, it's not just one person who gets to vote. And also in the case of the federal government, where they have to look at, you know, specific numbers that say whether a person's qualified. Even that person who's already picked out might not necessarily get that position. So, does anybody have anything else they want to say about that? So we've gotten through our summary of qualifications. You should also have your education listed on your resume, of course. So, you know, you'll have your degrees, your majors, graduation dates should all be on there. Depending on how relevant it is to the job you're applying for, you might have things like study abroad experiences, minors, your dissertation title might be on there. You might have classes that didn't lead to a degree. I know I had something like that on my resume. I had studied abroad in Spain, and I had classes that I took while I was in Spain because I wanted to show foreign language experience for one job I applied to. I also had, when I was applying, my PhD is in women's studies, and I had some summer classes I took at a university that I wanted to highlight that did not lead to a degree, but it was the same kind of thing. So you can think about putting that kind of thing on there. If you did well in school, you could put honors or GPA in that kind of section as well. That's a pretty straightforward section.
Actually, I have a question.
Yeah.
I've had mixed information on whether or not I'm in a situation where I'm getting really close to the end of my graduate schooling. But, you know, the end date sometimes is kind of fluid depending on, you know, what the defense is. Especially with government jobs, I've heard both things, that you should put the projected end date on there as you're applying. Or other people said, no, you don't want to do that, because they look at that and they say, maybe this guy is not going to be finished, you know, by the time he thinks he will be, and so, you know, he'll be working on his schoolwork while he's either interviewed or started the job already, and is either not going to get finished with school, or is not going to be working on the job, he's going to be working on schoolwork, you know.
Yeah. So the question is, should you put an expected date of graduation?
Right.
There. And if you do, does that make people uncertain of whether you're really going to finish by that time? And sometimes it's not clear whether you're going to finish. I would always put it, because I think first and foremost, if you don't put it, I think the first thing an employer is going to ask is, well, when does this person actually think they can start? Right, because that's one of their primary concerns in hiring somebody, particularly if that position, but often by the time a job is listed, they're already looking for somebody to fill that seat. And if they, so if they think, gosh, I don't even know when this person can start, I think that's going to be your first step to the no pile, versus if they can look at it and say, that looks like about the right time. And I would guess that in most cases, an employer is then going to try and nail you down on that. Are you really going to be done? That is one thing that that people get frustrated with too, is particularly with graduate students, a lot of times they say they're going to finish and then they don't finish. So I've noticed some certain fellowships and things are now starting to change their requirements so that you can't apply until you've finished. But I would put it down. You know, a lot of this, I know you probably don't think that there are career professionals who debate all of these things, but a lot of this is open for debate because you never know how that specific person, the hiring manager, is going to read your resume and interpret it. So you have to take everything kind of with a grain of salt. So related experience, actually I would shorten to that to just experience, but experience can be multiple different categories. So you could have your related experience and other experience. You could have categories like teaching experience, consulting experience, management experience, whatever categories apply to you and to the job that you're applying to. You can include volunteer experience and internships, that kind of thing, in this section if you want to really sell them as related. Otherwise, you can put them in another section at the end. That's up to you, and it's going to, again, depend on the job and your background. You're going to want to use, within that experience section, spend the most time on the positions that are most relevant to the job you're actually applying to. And you're going to want to put things like your position title, the organization name, dates of employment, the location you worked in, and then bullet points about your skills and experiences. And we'll talk a little bit more on the next slide about the kinds of things you want to be putting in your bullet points. Does anybody have any questions about that section? Yeah.
Well, I guess a step back. You mentioned some classes where maybe you didn't get a degree. Is that within the education section?
I would put it in the education section. You could put it anywhere. This is all, you know, it's an art, not a science. I would put it in the education section unless you didn't want to use it, unless it was not particularly relevant. If you put it in the education section, it's going up front. If you don't want to really show it off and it's not as important, I would put it kind of in another category at the bottom or in whatever category it best fits in. But depending on how relevant you think it is to the particular job you're applying for. So other things you might have on there, if you have honors and awards, you might put that on your resume. People always like to see that you've got honors. Publications. Now, if you're applying for a job where they're really going to care about your research, you're going to put your publications on there by title. You might not put the full citation because a full citation is going to take three whole lines for each publication. But if you're applying for something where they care about your research, go ahead and put the actual papers on there. If you're not, just say, you know, X number of papers published, X number of presentations. You can list the journals you were published in, maybe, or the conferences the presentations were at. But you don't need to actually go into detail. Just if it's a position where they want to see that, yes, you have some experience publishing, you can still get out that without going into detail that they don't need. Publications might also fit under somewhere else. So on my resume, because I don't do research anymore, I don't actually list my publications, but I have my research experience in a category under related experience. And in there, then I have something about my publications and presentations, rather than having a whole separate section for it, because it's not particularly relevant to the sort of work that I do anymore. If you have other training, professional training, certifications, that kind of thing, you want to make sure to list that on your resume. Again, that could go in a variety of places. That might go in your summary of qualifications up front. It might be its own training category. It might go in some kind of other category at the end. We already talked about volunteer activity. If you don't fold that into the experience sections at the top, you can make it its own category, and you'll do the same kind of thing where you list a position or a sort of work that you do, a field that you do volunteer work in, and do the same sorts of bullet points. And then at the end, an other skills category. If you have things that are relevant for the position, you haven't gotten it down on paper anywhere yet, this is where you want to put it. So it might be things like language skills, computer skills, specific research techniques they're looking for. You can put all of that in kind of an other skills section. So there's one other thing I don't have listed on here that I think should never be on a resume. You never need to waste space saying references available upon request, right? People know that. If they don't know that, they'll ask if they can have your references, right? You don't need to tell them. So do you have any other questions about this? Yeah.
I've seen some resumes lately with a section on synergistic activities, and I'm still not clear what those are.
So you, should you have synergistic activities? So that would be like collaborations, I would guess. Okay, personally, because I almost want to make a face at the word synergistic, and I'm like holding back because that's not very professional. I would not use that kind of buzzword on your resume unless you're applying somewhere where you know that's the kind of culture and attitude they're looking for. So if you are applying to a company and on their website they have a lot of those kinds of, I can't even come up with any on the top of my feet, but if they have a lot of that kind of language on their website, sure, go ahead and use it in your resume. Otherwise, I would think about where else you might fold in that kind of information. If you think collaboration is pretty important, I would think about folding it into my summary of qualifications at the top to if I really wanted to highlight it. You might put it in an other skills section. Collaborations, you might want to highlight, interdisciplinary experiences you have, because employers can value that sort of communication that you get from that kind of thing as well. Yeah.
And in general coursework related to your degree, leave most of that off? Or?
Coursework related to your degree. So you can put it in education. Sometimes you'll see a section where people will say something like related classes. And I would put, if that's what you want to put that there. If you want to go more in depth in it, say you had some big project class and you really want to highlight that project, you can highlight that as a volunteer experience or under one of your experience categories, somehow throw it in there using an appropriate heading for it. Your dissertation research should be in that experience category. I didn't say that explicitly, but it should be. Because certainly you've gained skills and experiences there that you want to be able to tell an employer about. Particularly if you're applying to jobs that they don't necessarily hire a lot of PhDs or PhDs from your particular background, you need to tell them what you're bringing to the table because they don't necessarily know about all the creative thinking, communication, problem-solving skills that you're bringing to the table. And you need to be able to communicate that, the project management, mentoring kind of things that you pick up in graduate school. They're not going to just read that line in your education experience where it says PhD and know that you bring that to the table. So you need to be able to sell that. Yeah.
You said to leave off the resumes available upon request, but one thing that I've seen lately is sometimes you're applying for a job and you don't really want to know your current employer to know that you're applying, but some of those might be your colleagues that you're working for as your references, and I've seen please maintain all references as confidentiality. Have you seen that? And would that be something that you might include?
So the question is about whether when you're giving your references to an employer, they're going to somehow accidentally tell your current employer that you're looking for a job. So I wouldn't give them the contact information for any references when you're applying. Unless this is going to differ. If you're applying for a job and they say they want the references up front, then yes, you're going to have to give them the references up front. And you could make a carefully crafted sentence that says something to the effect of, please don't tell people I'm on the market. Otherwise, when you give them that contact information, you can tell that to them. A lot of times they won't ask for references until they're ready to make an offer. And if that's the case, then you really want the offer, then you're probably okay with the confidentiality thing, because it's going to come out at some point anyway. Anybody have any other questions before I go to our CV slide? I think it's my next slide. Yeah.
That part of the project, in the line of CVs, have something targeted for a more academic setting. Would you say that the objective is not really important there, even though maybe it's not necessary to convey that you have specific targeted interests as far as where you're trying to go?
So on a CV, you could have like research interests up front, but I wouldn't have an objective on a CV either. I don't know that I've seen that. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen that in CVs.
I would say pretty much the same thing I would say about an objective and a resume. But the thing is, with a CV, you don't have as tight of a space constraint. You can make it as long as you want. So you can put it on a CV without harming your bottom line. But you still are using that valuable real estate at the top with the objective. Again, I think if you're able to say something in the objective that you can't get anywhere across anywhere else, that's fine. I just have rarely seen that. Yeah.
Hi.
I sometimes run into the problem is that the resumes are going through human resources, but they haven't a clue what they're reading. I don't know what to do. Do I send them a dictionary? I mean, sometimes it's very bad. I've been told soil chemistry isn't really chemistry because it's from the soil department.
Well, and yes, that is, depending on where you're applying, yes, your resume is not necessarily going to somebody who knows what you're doing. So how do you communicate to those people?
Yes.
And I think that gets back to what we were talking about earlier about the keywords, is that if you're mirroring the language and that's in the job description, that's going to get you a leg up on some of that, because that's the language they're going to know, because they've seen that job description and that job ad that they've put out there. So if they see the same language from the job ad in your resume or your cover letter, then I think that should help with some of that. And if there are pitfalls that you know, that soil chemistry will not be seen as chemistry, I think about this, if you feel comfortable with this, but from a marketing perspective, marketing yourself, just say you're a chemist. If you know you're applying somewhere where that's the kind of reaction you're going to get. So one of the ways, I've done this myself, my PhD is in women's studies. I don't always want to be walking around with a big feminist flag, right? So sometimes I'm listing the department I graduated from, I always list women's studies. But when I talk about myself, I talk about myself as a social scientist, unless I'm somewhere in an environment where I want people to know more about my background. Because that is something I have to defend when I'm talking to people. When I was on the job market, I had to defend myself as a feminist. And sometimes I'd rather get to that later after they've learned all the other things I bring to the table. So. I see a hand over here. Yeah.
Recently I've heard mixed opinions about including a photograph on a resume. No.
No. Don't put a photograph. That's a cultural thing. In some countries, it's common to include photographs, but I would not do it in the U.S. because that's going to be, again, in that same category where it's going to start to make companies uncomfortable about whether they're discriminating against whatever in the photograph, because you can tell race from a photograph, you can tell age from a photograph, you can tell whether somebody's pretty or not, are they discriminating on that based on the photograph. Just don't put it in. Unless they specifically ask, okay? I guess if you're going to be an actress, they're going to ask for a photograph, right? I can't necessarily off the top of my head come up with anywhere else where it would necessarily be that relevant. And honestly, if they want to find a picture of you, they can go Google image search you and they will find one anyway. Anybody else? Okay. So a little bit about strategy, and I think we've covered a lot of this now, so I'll try and get through this quickly. It's, remember, this is not a job description. It's a marketing tool. So you're trying to sell yourself, right? That's not normally the mindset we're in as scientists of trying to sell ourselves. But as you're going through this document, that would be at the top of my list. Remember, you're not listing also in your bullet points. Similarly, you're not just listing what you did at a job, but you're selling yourself in those bullet points. So you're listing the skills you bring to the table and trying to sell them in a way that shows off your accomplishments rather than just lists what you did. So again, it's a marketing tool. One thing that's really in vogue on resumes these days is to quantify things and come up with ways you can put numbers on your resume. And you see the examples online, they all tend to be very businessy about increased profitability by X percent. And you're not gonna, yeah, you're kind of like, well, what does that mean for me? What numbers can I put on my resume? Well, this is where you gotta think a little bit creatively, but there are some you can put out there. So things like, if you mentored students, put the number of students you mentored. If you had a grant with a budget, put down the number of grant size of the budget. Sorts of things like that. When I was an undergraduate, I ran programs like this and I had scores from evaluations and I could quantify the evaluation data that I had and put that in a line on my resume. So you have to think creatively, and it's not like every single statement on your resume is going to need to have a number in it, but if you can think of a couple places to put it in, it can tell a story. Another one that I have on my current resume is if I just had regularly give talks on professional development activities. Well, what the heck does regularly mean? You know, it's not that meaningful. But if I can say, gave 50 presentations a year, well, all of a sudden, that's a lot more meaningful. Because if regularly was 12 times a year versus 50, that's kind of different. So think about even things like that, you know, the number of experiments you're working on, the number of days you're spending in the field. What do you think will convince an employer that you're bringing a lot to the table? You've all probably heard this before, use action words on your resume. Right? So you want to say you led, managed, organized. Go as you're starting to work on your resume, just do a Google search for action words and have that list available so to help jog your memory to use them. So you use different ones too. You don't use the same ones over and over again. We already talked a lot about resume real estate, so I'm not going to talk about that much more. The other thing I would recommend, I always think it's useful to look at a template as you're working on your own resume. So go to University Career Services at your university or at another university. You can find lots of examples online. So look online and see if you can find somebody with a similar experience level to yours. So if you're an undergrad looking at the Career Center, hopefully they'll have some bachelor's level degrees. If you're a graduate student, try and find a Career Center that has examples of graduate student resumes, even graduate student resumes in the sciences. They are out there. So I think that's helpful. And then I think it goes without saying, but proofread your resume. You know, there are people out there who will just throw your resume out because they find typos annoying. So even though that may be petty, if there's a document you're trying to sell yourself on, proofread it. It makes perfect sense, right? So read it yourself, have somebody else read it, make sure it's clean. So CVs, I'm going to talk a little bit about these as well. Again, you're going to use slightly different categories on your CV. Some of these are very similar. The other thing I'm going to say about a CV is that CVs differ dramatically from field to field. So resumes, there's some consistency there. But a CV, you better also, other than just listening to what I have to say, although I know I have wonderful things to say, go speak to somebody in your department, on your committee, your advisor. A lot of times people say, but my advisor's CV, he's had his job for so many years, he doesn't really care. Well, go find the youngest person in the department who just wrote a CV for a job search and ask to see theirs, because they just got a job using that CV. Hopefully it looks good. And again, you're going to use this not necessarily just for academic job searches, but it could be for industry job searches too. If that's the case, I would ask people in the specific industry you're applying to, what is the norm? I know sometimes in the biotech industry, which is what I have to be most familiar with, that the industry CV will be a shortened version of the academic CV. So it won't necessarily follow the exact same guidelines. So you're still, and again, you can change the order of categories. You're not necessarily going to have every category, all of those kinds of things. Particularly, one thing you might do, depending on if you're applying to teaching or research positions, you would flip which one you put on top, right? Because if you're applying to a teaching position, you want to sell your teaching. If you're applying to a research position, you want to sell your research, right? So that's a little bit of a marketing strategy to go into your CV. So again, you're going to start at the top with your contact information. Same deal, make sure it's reliable. Again, you're going to include your education, but you might go a little bit more in detail on here. So in some fields, it's common to include things like all of your committee members, or to include things like the fields that you took exams in, that sort of thing. If you have certificates you got along with your graduate degree, you might put them in there. And you probably, if you're not done, want to include something about the status of your dissertation work. So this kind of gets at our question about putting your expected date of graduation. You could put something like a defense date. If you have a defense date scheduled, you can put that on a CV. You can also put things like collecting data or where you are in the dissertation process. So you can put a little bit more information about that process if you're ABD and you think it's relevant. Again, you can put honors and awards on there. If they're really good, put them up high at the front, because that resume, real estate, we want to sell things we've got that are good. Your teaching experience, you're going to have a category for that. So that might include both formal experiences, but particularly if you don't have a lot of TA experience, put some more informal things on there. When you did guest lectures, that kind of thing can be on there as well. So again, you'll have the same kind of listings with job titles, the school, the dates taught. You should also include information about your responsibilities. Just because you were TA doesn't mean you did the same number of things, or the same sorts of things. So make sure to include information about what your actual responsibilities in that position were. Did you grade papers, lead sections, actually teach the class, give lectures, the level of students taught? Did you teach freshmen, sophomores, upperclassmen, graduate students, and the number of students in the class? There's a big difference between a 15-person class and a 150-person class. So all of that should be in there. And then you'll have a bunch of categories for research experience. And again, this is the kind of thing where it's going to differ depending on the field you're in. So this is where you have to go ask somebody who's more knowledgeable with your particular field. But you might have things like your publications. Well, I'm not going to say you might have your publications. Your publications will be on your CV. That goes without saying. And you generally list them with a full citation. Some people will do things, particularly if they're not first author on a paper, like underline their name to draw attention to it. You'll also likely have a section of your presentations. Again, list these with a full citation. That will include things like the date of the presentation, where you gave the presentation, the conference, the city, that kind of thing. grants might be on here as well. Sometimes if you've held research positions within organizations, that would be on here. Works in progress, in some fields, it's common to put works in progress. All of those sorts of things. Again, it depends on where you are. So it speaks specifically to somebody familiar with your area. You might have other professional experience categories, particularly things like if you have a bunch of consulting experience, clinical experience, field work, and that's relevant, you might have categories for those sorts of things. Professional training, again, if you have certifications or trainings that aren't listed elsewhere, you can have that on there. You'll typically have a category for professional service. So this will be a service to the department, the university, your field of research, your community. So this could be serving on a committee on your campus. It could be serving on a committee in a professional association, something like that. Those sorts of things are listed on your CV. You also generally have a section for professional associations. Sometimes people will put that on their resume as well, but we didn't talk about that when we talked about resumes because, again, I would say that's not necessarily the most valuable use of your space on your resume. It's valuable on a resume if you're able to sell me something about it. I'm a member of this organization, and not only do I pay the dues, I'm also involved in this other thing. But if you're just listening because you pay dues to it, I don't think it adds enough to your resume. On your CV, if it's the culture in your field to include it, go ahead and include it. And sometimes references are actually just included on a CV. In some fields, it's common to just have a page at the back with everybody's full contact information. So if that's what's common in your field, go ahead and do it. Make sure, though, that as you send that CV out, that the people whose names are listed on there, they know that you've sent their name out. You don't want anybody getting any surprises. Anybody have any questions about CVs? No. So cover letters, generally you're going to send a cover letter to with each of these positions. I say generally because you can't always send one. If anybody's applied for jobs online, you've probably had that experience where there's no place to submit a cover letter. And that can be really frustrating, but you've got to at least take into consideration that nobody applying for that job can submit a cover letter. And particularly if you're in that situation, that's a place where I would think about using that summary of qualifications at the top of the resume or even at the top of the CV to really sell yourself because you don't get the cover letter to sell yourself. You have to do it in the context of the resume. So you want to make sure that your cover letter, again, it's not just going to be a restatement of your CV or your resume, but it's going to add something to the table. And there are some differences between academic and non-academic cover letters. Generally, an academic cover letter is allowed to be longer. And again, this is one of those things where it differs by fields. In some fields, it's still a three-paragraph letter. In other fields, I've seen it be 5 pages or more. That's uncommon. I think the most common is going to be about 2 pages, 5 to 8 paragraphs, something like that. But again, speak to people who are more familiar with the field. Ask recent hires if you can see their cover letters as you're applying. So basically, at the beginning, you want to have your opening paragraph. If you're applying again to non-academic jobs, we're only talking about 3 paragraphs. We don't have too much to write. You want to identify the position you're applying for. If you've seen something like a position number online, include that as well because the company has that number for a reason to make it easier for them. So make sure to include that. You want to make sure they know that you're enthusiastic about the position, right? And that you really want to work for them. Again, it's a selling thing. You're selling yourself to them. Sometimes you might say where you heard about the job, you know, particularly if this can be a selling point. I'm familiar with, your company because I know so-and-so, and they suggested I apply. So if you can sell somebody's name in the context of a letter, may as well. And sometimes you'll say a little something about yourself in that paragraph, but mainly the goal is to identify the position you're applying to so they know what you're applying to and tell them you really want to work for them. The middle paragraph is kind of the meat of a letter and where you actually get to do a little bit more of that discussion of your skills. And it says paragraphs up there, again, because this is what you're going to expand on if you're doing that longer letter for an academic position. So it'll be multiple paragraphs if you're in academic positions. So here you're trying to show them what a good fit you are for the position and your value to the employer. So you're going to expand on detail on the skills in your resume, making sure not to just say what's in there, but adding to it. Illustrate things with some stories, discuss some of your skills in detail. And again, if you can, to some extent, mirror some language and pick up on things that are in the job ad. Just like you did in the resume. End it by summarizing your strengths, saying thank you for your consideration. You might mention your enclosures or if you're going to follow up, you can do all of that there. You can also put things in the ending paragraph like, I'm really excited about applying for a job in the D.C. area. I'd love to move back to D.C. because my family's there. You can say little things like that that don't really mean much, but if they think, oh gosh, this person actually wants to move to the city, so even though they're applying from across the country, they will actually move here, that can kind of sell them on it. Another thing, in job interviews, I've had questions like, this place you're applying is in a really rural area. Do you really want to move to a rural area? You can say something like that, and it's kind of, you know, not the most important thing, but if you say it If you say it in a cover letter, then they can say, oh, this thing that I might be worried about, I don't have to worry about it. Or you can say something about why you're really excited to work in that field. I think there's an opportunity to sell yourself a little bit more and to get at that in the context of a cover letter. One thing we haven't talked about is if you're applying to a job and you know there's something that they're looking for that you don't have. Sometimes people like to talk about that in their cover letter. I know I don't have this skill, but I would say don't ever bring that up. You can talk about it in the context of an interview because they probably will ask. You know, one of the things we want in somebody is somebody who has the skill, but I notice you don't have that skill. Don't tell them in the cover letter because then you're just bringing attention to a reason they should disqualify you. Does anybody have any other questions about that? Okay. So we've got a half hour left. We've got a little bit more to get through, and then we're on interviews. So you might have some other application materials. Again, this is going to be more common with those academic job applications than with non-academic job applications. So I'm not going to go into too much detail about these, other than just to kind of talk about it briefly. You might be asked for a research statement to talk a little bit about the projects you're working on and the projects you might want to work on in the future. It should be pretty broad in scope, designed for a non-specialist to read it. And talk about the significance of your project, both scientifically and to society as well. And again, it should lay out a clear roadmap for your future plans if you get the job. Again, for academic jobs, you might be asked for a teaching statement as well. This is a place you can talk about your teaching philosophy, your teaching objectives, your methods for doing that, and that kind of thing, a little bit about your teaching experience as well. We talked a little bit about lists of references and letters of reference earlier. Some jobs will ask for those letters of references up front. Other jobs will ask for references later on in the process. When they ask for that list of references, chances are they're going to call that person. They're not going to ask them to write a letter, but that's not always the case. I've seen where they've asked for a list of references and then they've contacted those people and said, now can you provide a letter? One of the things I always recommend is all of your references, you should give them your complete application packet so they know what you have told those employers. You should also give them a list of talking points. If there are particular experiences that you want them to highlight when they are talking to those people or highlight in their letter, remind them of it. Remind them of the project you worked on in that professor's class. Remind them of that experience you had together so that they know what to talk about. It makes it easier for them. Particularly if you're applying to non-research jobs, sometimes it can make people a little bit anxious. Or if you're applying to something that person doesn't necessarily know tons about, explain to them the skills of your skills that they know about that they can sell. So giving those talking points just makes it easier for them. So once you've sent all your applications in, hopefully you have some way to follow up on your applications. Hopefully in all that networking we talked about, it feels like a long time ago, right? You got a contact in that company. So after you've sent it in, get in contact with them, tell them I sent it in. You might send them a copy as well and ask if they can pass it off directly to the hiring manager. That helps in case you're in that position where your application gets held up in HR because HR doesn't understand your application. Somebody else in the company knows you applied and can say, hey, Sally applied and her application's really good. Why didn't I get hers? They can go to HR and say that if they know you actually applied. And also following up in your applications once you've sent them in, it just reinforces your interest in the position. It wasn't just one of a million applications you were sending off, it was one you really wanted. So now we're to talking about interviewing. This is our last section. Hopefully you're about 3 months out, you're starting to get interviews. Here's one quote from this guy, Martin Yeat, and he says, there are two terrible places to be in an interview. Sitting in front of the desk, wondering what on earth is going to happen next, and sitting behind the desk asking questions. The average interviewer dreads the meeting almost as much as the interviewee. And I put this one up there because I don't think we always remember that. Well, a lot of times we think it's like a test, and we've got to prove that we know everything so we can get the job. But the person interviewing you is just as anxious as well because they're hoping they find somebody to take the job. Somebody they want to work with, spend a lot of time with, who's going to be a good fit for their organization and bring the skills they need. So they're just as anxious as you. Here's another one, and this is from Peter Fisk, the guy who should be a butler that we talked about earlier. And he says, the goal of an interview is to get you a job offer, or at least another interview. If you handle the interview well, you will show the employer that, in addition to your outstanding technical qualifications and background, you're a good communicator, an organized, prepared, and logical thinker, and someone who would add value to the organization. That's a lot to do in the context of an interview, isn't it? So interviews are success. That's your first sign that somebody likes your job application, right? Give yourself a little pat on the back just for getting an interview. It's a sign that you're somewhere near the top of the list. So coming into the interview, I just talked about this a little bit. You're going to have goals and they're going to have goals. They want to find out why you want to work for them. Why did you even apply to this job? How you benefit the organization and whether you're somebody they want to work with. You've got some different goals. You want to find out, will I enjoy this job and will it help me ultimately reach my career goals? One of the things I like to say about interviews is to remember that they're a conversation, not an interrogation, right? So it's not that they're just interrogating you trying to get the information, but it's that you're both having a conversation about what the job is, what you bring to the table, and the culture of the organization to figure out if it's a fit for both of you. Because you should always be asking in the context of a job interview, is this a job I want? So that when you get an offer, you can make an informed decision about whether you really want to be there. So when you're preparing for the interview, a couple things to think about. It's always a good idea to plan your transportation. That's sometimes obvious if you have to travel, but if you're just talking about driving somewhere you don't normally drive, figure out how long it's really going to take you to get there so you can make sure to give yourself some extra time. Driving directions, where are you going to park? All of that. Make sure you have that all mapped out ahead of time. As you're preparing, you might also think a little bit about the content of the interview. So this would be thinking through some common interview questions. There are some things they're probably going to ask. They're probably going to say, tell me about yourself, and then expect you to say something back that sounds informed and coherent, right? So you know that's coming. You can prepare ahead of time. At the same time, you can find these lists of interview questions on the internet, and then they'll have, like, here's a good answer to that question. Okay, you can read through those. They can be a good brainstorming exercise to think about how might I respond to these questions. And there's some value in seeing what other people think are common questions. But don't go memorize a bunch of lists, because then you're going to sound like you've memorized a bunch of information. And I don't think you're going to sound like a fun person that people actually want to work with, right? You're going to sound like somebody who's parroting back a bunch of hackneyed stereotyped answers to interview questions, okay? So read through if you want. Don't memorize them. The other thing you need to do before you get there is develop your own questions. Spend a little bit of time thinking about what do you want to learn in the context of that interview. What do you want to learn about the company and the job? And if they asked you to prepare anything, you should prepare it. If they asked for a job talk, which of course in an academic job, they're going to ask for at least a job talk. Sometimes you might be asked to teach a class as well. But sometimes in industry settings, you'll be asked for this as well. In the context of my job, I was asked to give a presentation on things I thought were important for the professional development of young scientists. So again, not quite a job talk, but they asked me to prepare something. So it may not be a job talk per se. So figure out exactly what they want, figure out how long they want you to spend talking, figure out who the audience is going to be so you can aim it correctly at the right audience. And find out if you're asked to do a job talk, find out a little bit more from people in your field about what is expected in a job talk. It might not be that they just want to know about your research. They probably want to know more about things like your involvement in your research, the thought process involved, collaborations, those sorts of things. So tailor it to what you found out about that company in that field. So the other thing you want to do before you show up at a company is do a little bit of research on that company. When you get there, they're probably going to say something like, so what do you know about AAAS? And you want to be able to say something informed that makes you sound enthusiastic about the job, right? So do a little bit of research. It's going to show your enthusiasm and that you're informed. So you can read the company's website and other literature they put out. So if they have an annual report, you can read product literature. Do a little bit of reading of what they put out. You can also do things like read up on industry, in industry resources, industry newsletters about the company. Do a Google News search. Have they been in the news recently? Has it been for good things or not, you know? And again, if you know, have contacts in the field, talk to current employees, ask them about things you might want to find out about in the context of the job interview. You can also research the field more generally. So even if you know somebody who has a similar position at another company, ask them about the kinds of things they think you might want to be asking this company. And if you show up informed about their competitors as well, they'll probably be impressed that you can ask questions related to that. Basically, the point of that question is that at some point, they're probably going to say something about, what do you know about us or why do you want to work for us? And if you know nothing about them, you can't say anything, right? You should have some reason why you want to work for that company. So here's Mike. He's in his interview now. Okay, Mike, here's a puzzle we give to all of our interviewees. Suppose n number of people have x coins, but none of them have pockets. How many eggs must they break to cross the river, assuming the fox will eat the chicken? 4? Wow, that's right. How'd you do it? He's thinking, I read it on the internet. That's PhD training. So I guess he found some value in memorizing those answers. So some common interview questions you might want to think about before you get there. And if we have time, we're not going to have time. I am taking my full time. I was going to make you practice responses to these questions, but we're running low on time. So think about things before you show up, like tell me about yourself. That's a common question. What are your strengths and weaknesses? We've all heard that one, right? And I know when I was on the job market, I thought nobody's actually going to ask what are my weaknesses. That's such a stereotypical question. I was asked. And luckily, I came up with an answer on the spot. But we'll talk in a little bit, I think, about some good answers to questions. We already talked about why this organization. You should also be able to tell them why this job. Why do you want to be a professor? Why do you want to have this sort of research position? Why is that of appeal to you? You want to be able to tell them what you can do for them and what you're bringing to the table. If you're leaving research too, I would be prepared for people to ask. Generally, I expect somebody with a PhD to go get a research job. Why aren't you doing that? And have an answer that's not going to sound bitter, like you would rather be somewhere else, but this is where you ended up. The other thing, you want to show up with some questions that you want to ask about the job and the company. Does anybody have any ideas about the kinds of questions you might want to ask? Well, gosh, it's a good thing you guys are here. Nobody can give me a response. Okay, so here's my list. Ask about things like, what does the job entail? What will my actual responsibilities be like? What will I be doing on a daily, weekly, monthly basis? Ask about the opportunities for advancement. People who've held this position before, where have they gone in the company? Where have they gone outside the company? Ask them, is there anything they'll do to help with your professional development? Sometimes they'll pay for you to take classes, pay for you to go to trainings. Maybe there's a mentoring program in the company. Ask about those kinds of things. Ask about the future goals for the organization. If the organization's growing in a lot of ways that aren't as that much of interest to you, maybe it's not somewhere you really want to be. Or maybe they've got all these new initiatives that make the company seem much more exciting to you. Ask about the roles of different team members. You're likely, in the course of the day, going to be meeting with several people. And ask each of them what they do and figure out how often you would actually be working with that person. And ask things about the culture of the organization. Are people friendly here? Do they get lunch together? Do they hang out after work? What's the normal response to X, Y, or Z happening? What's the general feel of the halls in the company? How friendly are people? Those sorts of things. So the day of, I have this up there, dress appropriately even if you don't want to, right? Most scientists don't put suits on a lot of the time, and sometimes we would really, really prefer not to. So I put this quote from Peter Fisk up there because I think it appeals to us as scientists, and he says, you have to admit, for most other animals in nature, appearance is a life or death issue. Animals judge each other's health, strength, and parental fitness, not by subjecting their mates to an interview, but by examining certain external qualities. People evaluate each other all the time using similar traits. So there's a little bit of a scientific argument for it. Basically, if you show up like you know the rules, and one of the rules of the interview game is that you wear a suit, that shows that you're playing the game. So I would argue that you do that. I know sometimes I get the response from people, but people in my field really, really, really never wear a suit. Okay, well, if you've done your networking and you have some contacts in the company, ask if that's really okay. The other thing, you want to make sure you arrive early. Better to arrive early than late. If you get there too early, and too early is going to be more than 10 minutes early, walk around the block, go get a cup of coffee. You don't want to walk in really early to an interview because you know what it does if you're 20 minutes early? It ticks people off. They weren't ready for you yet. And that's not the way you want to start an interview, right? So while you're there, you're going to have a few different goals. First goal is going to be to promote yourself and your strengths. That makes sense in the context of an interview. So in the context of this, keep in mind that you're trying to appear to be somebody that they want to be their colleague and somebody that they want to spend time around. So the first thing to do would be to mind your manners. That goes without saying. Say please and thank you. Somebody holds a door for you, for example. Make sure to express enthusiasm for the position in the company. They want to work with somebody who wants to be there. Make sure that that comes across. Be sure not to talk negatively. Again, that goes along with the enthusiasm thing, but particularly talking negatively about prior jobs or employers. They don't want to think that you're somebody who is going to have that same attitude once you come to work there. So even if you're really bitter about the graduate school experience, don't let it come across once you're in the context of an interview. And we talked as well about being prepared, or mentioned earlier, being prepared to talk about your weaknesses. And you don't give that same response, I work too hard, should not be your response to what are your weaknesses. Talk about a problem that you do have, something you're doing to make it better, and how it has gotten better is one way to answer that question. I'll tell you, in my job interview, I already told you I wasn't prepared for the question and they asked it. So what I said, in graduate school I had a job, I was running similar events like this, and I had evaluation data, and I said, well, the hardest thing for me to do in my job is to read that evaluation data because I take it so personally that I get really upset if anybody says something slightly negative. So that was my problem, is that I couldn't read the evaluation data and deal with it. I solved that by realizing that I have to read it, I put it down for a day or two, and then I can get the emotional response over with, I can come back and deal with it like as a professional and get it done with. So apparently that was a good enough answer. So there you go, there's my example of an answer to that question. Does anybody have any other questions about that stuff? Okay. Make sure while you're there you want to answer their questions as best you can, of course. That's pretty obvious. The one thing I'd like to say is pause for thought or ask for clarification if you don't understand the question. It's not a test. Again, it's a conversation. One good rule of thumb is that you should be doing about 50% of the talking and they should be doing about 50% of the talking. So it's okay to say, I didn't understand the question. It's also okay to take a few seconds to collect your thoughts rather than just trying to spurt out the first thing that comes to mind. It's also important to stay in the moment. You might start to get tired and start drifting off. Be conscious of that and make sure you continue to pay attention because there's nothing worse than having to say in a job interview, I wasn't paying attention. You know, you don't want to go there. Be mindful of how long your answers are to questions. So you should cap them about 2 minutes. Don't talk any longer than that. I was speaking with somebody from Kelly Scientific, which is a recruiting company that works with scientists, and she said that she was in a job interview once. As a recruiter, she was sitting in on this job interview with one of her candidates in the prospective company, and they said, tell me about yourself. And the guy spoke for 20 minutes. And then they were done talking. They ended the interview right after he finished answering because that was not the appropriate context for giving a 20-minute lecture about yourself. If you think you've got more to say after your 20 seconds or 2 minutes, you can say, would you like to hear more about X, Y, or Z? And they can say yes or no. And if they say no, let's move on, I want to talk about something else, fine. And again, 2 minutes kind of doesn't sound like a long time, but if you time yourself talking about anything for 2 minutes, it's a fairly long time. You can get a fair number of thoughts across. And again, you want to make sure that they're getting across what they want to get across, too, because you want them to enjoy the experience of interviewing you. So generally, a conversation is going to be a little bit more enjoyable for the person on the other end. Never lie about anything, really. That goes without saying. But again, you want to make sure you're as honest as you can be. If they ask questions about salary, don't name a number first, if you can. There are some exceptions to this. There are some companies that require a salary range when you apply, but assuming you're not in one of those situations, and we can talk more later about that if you'd like, try not to name a number first. Generally, if they're the first ones to name a number, you have more bargaining power. And sometimes they will ask kind of off the cuff in the context of an interview. That's why I put that in there. The other thing is to be prepared about,
Is it appropriate, I've heard some people say when they ask you that, just say it's negotiable?
That's okay, or saying I would want a salary commensurate with my experience, something along those lines. There are companies, though, that will not even consider job applications without a salary range. So if you see something in when you're submitting your application materials that require a salary range, some people say even in that context, don't give it and just say one of those lines. But I would say personally, if they're not going to consider your application without a salary range and you actually want the job, do some research, talk to people in the company, go to salary websites, use the federal government pay scales, come up with a number and give them a number. Because if you're not going to get even considered without the number, I would rather than give them a number than not be considered. The other thing to be prepared for is that sometimes people will ask questions they're not supposed to ask in the context of an interview. People are not supposed to ask about your race, they're not supposed to ask about religion, marital status, parental status. If any of that comes up, you can deflect the question. You can either say, you know, I'd rather not talk about that. I can't see where that's relevant to the job at hand. You know, if you're worried about me having kids and not working very hard, I assure you that won't be a problem. You don't have to answer it. It's probably best not to say, that's an illegal question. I don't think you should be asking that. Because in the context of an interview, you're going to be talking to several people. Chances are several of those people will not know the employment law and won't know they're not supposed to answer those. And these questions can come up really easily if there are more informal parts to the interview. If they take you out for a drink afterwards, if there's a meal that's part of the interview, it's just something people think to ask, and they don't even remember that it's the context of an interview. So be conscious of that. You can answer it if you don't feel like it's going to be a problem, but they're not supposed to ask, and you don't have to answer. Does anybody have any questions about any of that? So remember, you're there to find out more. We talked a little bit about some questions you want to ask. So remember, this is a conversation. You're both going to be talking about 50% of the time. You're going to make sure to ask your prepared questions that you made the list ahead of time. Check in with yourself throughout the day. Ask yourself, how is this company? How are the people around here? How nice were they when I walked in the door? Do I like being here? So when you go home, you have some mental thoughts about whether you wanted to be working there or not. At the end of the day, it's always a good idea to ask, how will the process proceed? When should I expect to hear about you? Will there be another round of interviews? You can ask how many people are in consideration at that point. Get a sense of that at the end of the day. The other thing, we talked about business cards already. And no, business cards are not my favorite thing on the planet, but they come up a lot in job searches. So you should get a business card from everybody you talk to during the day because you want to be able to email them afterwards, thank them for their time, maybe clarify any thoughts you have. And if you don't have their contact information, you can't do that. So at the end of each little meeting, you can just say, can I have your business card? Yeah.
So when you go to an interview where you don't deal with multiple people, you should email everybody you met, even if you just send one thank you note to your primary interviewer?
I don't think it's a bad idea to send everybody an email. You should definitely be sending it to the hiring manager, at the very least.
You do email with a separate note?
Email's fine. I don't think anybody's going to quibble over, I didn't get a handwritten note.
Okay.
And the other thing is, particularly because you don't know what their hiring process is going to look like, if you send an email, you can get them a note that day or later that day, whereas if you send something in the mail, it may take several days for it to get there. So the other thing is to be mindful of your nonverbal communication. So think a little bit about your handshake when you go in that day. Make sure you have a firm handshake, but not too firm. Only pump a couple times. You know, there are those people who shake your hands and they just keep holding your hand. Wipe your hand off if it's a little sweaty. You're going to be a little nervous. Think about all those things. Make sure to use good eye contact. Again, this can be a cultural thing. In the U.S., we value eye contact, so make sure to make eye contact. Use good posture and don't fidget. Again, that's part of making it look like you're paying attention throughout the day. And make sure to speak clearly. There's nothing more annoying than if you're an interviewer and you can't hear the person who's talking because they just are talking so softly. And if you have to keep saying, excuse me, can you repeat that? It's kind of annoying. So try and speak clearly. After the interview, we just talked about this a little bit, you want to follow up. So send notes. And again, you want to say thank you, expressing your appreciation for the time, your enthusiasm about the job, you know, reinforcing that you want to work for them. You can clarify things that came up in the interview. If you want to say something else, you can send additional documents. Maybe you talked about a publication of yours and you want to actually send them a copy of that paper. Maybe it's a job where you applied with your resume because your research wasn't really pertinent, but now you want to send them your CV so they can know even more about you. Whatever, you can send additional things in that note as well. Here's Mike. Mike, we want to make you a job offer. Sharp analytical skills is one of the reasons we like to hire PhDs, so name your price. Well, in terms of salary, I know what I'm worth, and I'm not willing to accept anything less than what I currently make as a grad student. Low expectations is the other reason. So I'm going to a couple quotes as we're closing. One is from Lori Conlon, who I mentioned earlier from the NIH, who runs their postdoc office, and she says, "There's no secret. Each job search is different. I can't tell you everything you need to know about the job search. There's no one magical formula. You never know how it's going to play out. So just be prepared for that." And then I like this other quote. It came from the Chronicle of Higher Education. And in light of the current situation, he says, "Hope. You can't know the future, so why not hold on to your optimism? A tough labor market can cultivate strengths that you never developed before. Unemployment can lead to despair and flight, but it can also strengthen character." So I think the message of hope and being hopeful during your job search can be incredibly useful. So I think the main take-homes as you're out there, be confident, courteous, and positive as you talk to people. Those are the kinds of people people want to be around. Those are the kinds of people people want to hire. It's going to make the whole process easier. Follow up with people you met, not only people you networked with, but people you interviewed with. And learn from the process. You're not going to get every job you apply to. If you do, you probably need to start writing books on applying to jobs. So even if you don't get that job, try and learn from it and think about how you can use that in your next job application. A couple resources. We have a job search webinar we did a couple weeks ago comparing industry and academic job searches. It was a good discussion with some recruiters, academics, a woman from the NIH. So if you're interested in that, you can find it at sciencecareers.org/webinar. It's an hour long, so it's not going to take tons of your time. I already mentioned all of our resources on sciencecareers.org, so I'd recommend checking those out. And if you want to download these slides, they're on my website as well, so sciencecareers.org/outreach. And I brought some booklets and pens and handouts. There's some more in the back and there's some up front if you didn't get them when you came in. And we have like 5 minutes left. I didn't think I was going to take the whole time, but there you go. I'm happy to answer questions if you guys have them.
Anybody have any questions?
Nope. Well, I'm happy to chat if you want to chat about anything. Thanks, guys, for coming.